The civil war in Syria started more than 8 years ago with the Arab Spring, when civilians took to the streets to protest the authoritarian regime of President Bashar al-Assad. In response, Assad and his government started imprisoning and torturing the people who stood up to the regime, crushing that opposition and creating a culture of fear that contributed to the mass exodus of refugees. The horrific program continues today.
There are at least 127,000 people still inside or missing from that system. But that's an undercount because that's only the cases which were specifically documented to the organization that keeps the closest track of these numbers.
Anne Bernard is the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a reporter for The New York Times, where she was the Beirut Bureau Chief from 2012 to 2018. And she has a new piece in The Times that extensively details the torture of civilians by the Assad regime.
I haven't heard anyone describe going into these torture prisons without being tortured. There's a thing called reception where on the moment they arrive in a certain one of the hundreds of facilities, there's a systematic beating just on arrival. And then it sort of goes downhill from there, both in terms of specific torture methods under interrogation that go from basic to really baroque and sadistic, to just a level of neglect that UN investigators have labeled the crime against humanity of extermination, because so many people die simply from the untreated injuries, lack of food, lack of hygiene, et cetera.
Now, let's be clear that this program that you're describing targeted civilians. What impact did that have in this war, Anne?
It played a critical role in the ability of President Assad to overcome a mass movement of political protests against his rule. This was a movement that began with largely peaceful street protests, and this system existed before, and it was actually one of the reasons that people went in the street to protest. But it also was a tool for suppressing those protests, raising the costs unbearably high for people that participated in them, because merely participating in a protest or even liking a Facebook post about a protest could land you into this system. And for women, there was this extra price, and men as well, actually. Sexual abuse of men was also rampant, is also rampant inside. But this raised the price, especially for women, because of the double punishment, whereby in a conservative society, there's a stigma for anyone who was in the prison because of the assumption that they've been sexually abused or raped.
There are 5 million Syrian refugees still in Europe and the Middle East. Is this system affecting those folks? Or what are the tentacles of this, if you will? Yeah.
So this system has many tentacles that reach out into the larger world. It's not just a story about Syria. So, for instance, one of the main reasons that the 5 million refugees who are outside of Syria do not want to go home is because they fear for their security. And there are many elements of insecurity in the prospect of returning to Syria right now. But one of the main ones for a lot of people is the threat of being sucked into this system, even just because of the town they're from, or because they avoided army service, or because they are related to someone who may have once protested. There are already cases of people that have taken the chance to return or who remained inside Syria and took what the government called reconciliation deals, that you can come out of a rebel-held area and rejoin the government's world, so to speak, and you're supposed to be okay. But there are numbers of documented cases of people getting sucked into the system after accepting one of those deals. So this is an ongoing problem for the refugee crisis. And, of course, it also has this larger meaning, which is that we're in a moment in the world right now where there's a growing authoritarian wave. And the fear of refugees, the fear of terrorism, which is often conflated with refugees, even though they're actually the ones trying to escape terrorism, both the violence of their government and the violence of militants, this fear of refugees has boosted the right wing in many countries, and it's affecting politics, it's affecting international organizations and the ability of countries to agree on things as important as the meaning of Europe or how to respond to humanitarian crises. And at the same time, the fact that a leader can get away with this kind of mass atrocity using the machinery of the state to carry that out and essentially win by that means, creates this very dangerous example for other authoritarian leaders who might say, well, I should get a system like that or expand the one I already have because it works.
The frustrating thing when you talk about, and beyond frustrating, I mean, I think the heartbreaking part of this is whether or not this regime will ultimately be held responsible for these deaths.
That is one of the most painful aspects, as you said, but it's also an aspect where there is a tiny bit of hope in the sense that there are efforts to seek justice and accountability. Now, there won't be any kind of Syrian transitional justice process anytime soon, since Assad remains in power with no sign of reforms on the horizon. But Syrians are taking this into their own hands. Syrian human rights lawyers themselves, who are themselves, many of them, survivors of this torture, are working with European lawyers to launch cases in countries in Europe which have something called universal jurisdiction, where they can, the law provides the opportunity to try war crimes even if they haven't happened in that country, if they've happened to someone who's now in that country, or if a perpetrator is in the country. So there are cases now in Germany, France, and other European countries that are seeking to bring these details to court. They've won arrest warrants for some top security officials who are still sitting in Syria. Now, those people aren't going to actually be arrested and hauled into court, but it is a way to keep this on the table, to keep it in the public eye, to keep it in front of governments who may be thinking about normalizing with this system, and just a way to keep new information coming out and being archived, including documents from the government that have been smuggled out. There are, with 127,000 people at a minimum still missing in this system, each of those people has a large family. So we're talking about millions of Syrians who have been affected by this and may be in limbo because of a missing family member that they are not really even going to be allowed to speak of publicly.
Anne Bernard is the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a reporter at the New York Times, where she was the Beirut Bureau Chief from 2012 to 2018. Anne, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, Tanzina.
You can find a link to Anne Bernard's full story in The Times at thetakeaway.org.